I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, the legacy of Gerald Ford and the Ford family. But first, today the Bush administration is proposing putting the polar bear on the endangered species list, citing global warming as the cause of the great animal's demise. The proposed listing is part of a legal settlement with three environmental groups, including the Natural Resources Defense Council. Joining us is the NRDC's Andrew Wetzler. Andrew, your reaction to this proposal from the Interior Department?
Well, this is a profound win, not only for the polar bear, but for all the conservation groups, which for years have been trying to get the federal government to take positive action to solve the problem of global warming.
What is the argument? What's the problem for polar bears?
Polar bears are completely dependent on sea ice in the Arctic for their survival. They use the ice, particularly in the summer, to find food, to locate mates, to migrate. And as the Arctic warms, and it's warming about twice as fast as the rest of the globe, their sea ice habitat is literally melting away, and that is threatening the polar bears with extinction.
And we understand that scientists have seen the effects of this, polar bears cannibalizing each other, swimming in large groups when they don't normally do that, in places where they're not normally seen?
Yes, that's right. Stresses have been noted, particularly in the Beaufort Sea population, which has seen a really unprecedented instances of cannibalism among polar bears that scientists feel are essentially starving, and so eating each other in desperation, and also a real spike in the number of polar bears that have been observed swimming offshore, many of whom, for the first time, have been observed dead, having drowned in storms.
Well, an anonymous Interior Department official told the Washington Post that this proposal today, which, by the way, means that it'll be up for public comment for the next 90 days, this proposal is really sort of a scientific hypothesis. You put this out to the world and say, tell us, is this right or is this wrong? But you say that it's a momentous occasion for the Bush administration. Why? How are you reading this politically?
Well, the first thing to recognize is that the Endangered Species Act requires the Fish and Wildlife Service to make proposals like this based on the best available science. So the fact that the polar bear is being proposed for listing under the Endangered Species Act means that the Bush administration and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service have determined that the best available science says that global warming is causing polar bears to go extinct. And that's why it's potentially a real sea change for this administration, which has been so resistant historically to taking any meaningful positive actions to solve the global warming problem.
Do you think this will mean that the Bush administration might change some policy, might, for instance, look to encourage auto manufacturers to curb emissions?
Well, we certainly hope that things will move in that direction, and I think regardless of whether or not the Bush administration does during its last 2 years, there are certainly signs that the Republican Party is moving in that direction. I think that John McCain is probably the best example of that.
But as you all know, there's debate within the scientific community. Even those who agree that there is global warming, some disagree that it's caused by human activities.
The overwhelming number of scientists, the overwhelming amount of scientific information all points to human-caused global warming as a proven theory.
Well, as you know, there are scientists who feel that the verdict isn't yet in, that global warming is caused by human activities, such as car emissions. And I'm just wondering, is it possible that the Bush administration might acknowledge global warming, but then decide that the jury is out on what's causing it?
Anything is possible. But again, the scientific evidence about global warming is simply overwhelming at this point. And there really is no longer a serious scientific dispute about the fact of global warming. Global warming is real.
Well, and what about the polar bears? How long before they might become extinct?
Nobody knows for sure, but the estimates keep getting shorter and shorter. The most recent scientific estimates predicts that the Arctic may be entirely ice-free in the summer as soon as 2045. And if the Arctic becomes ice-free during the summer, it's very unlikely the polar bears will survive. So we have gone from seeing a situation where polar bears may go extinct in the wild in our children's lifetime to a situation where polar bears may go extinct in the wild in our lifetime unless we take action to solve global warming now.
What sort of steps do you and your organization want to see to try to help polar bears?
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has 1 year to finalize this proposed rule. There will be a 3-month period for the public to submit comments, and there may be public hearings held as well, which we'll certainly be participating in. After the polar bear is listed, of course, the Endangered Species Act will provide a large toolkit. The Endangered Species Act requires that essential polar bear habitat be protected. It requires the federal government to consult with the Fish and Wildlife Service before it takes any action. And it prohibits private individuals from taking polar bears unless they have a specific permit to do so.
Andrew Wetzler, director of the Endangered Species Project at the nonprofit Natural Resources Defense Council. Andrew, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, as we head into 2007, foreign relations top the agenda as the U.S. looks abroad for help in solving the problem of Iraq. But whatever happened to concerns about China? Journalist John Pomfret says the world's gaze diverted from China after 9/11 and two wars. But he brings the economic superpower front and center in his fascinating book, Chinese Lessons, Five Classmates and the Story of the New China. In 1980, John attended Nanjing University, one of the first American exchange students admitted after China's brutal Cultural Revolution. He later returned as a reporter and traced the lives of five of his fellow students. They were children when Mao Zedong initiated his Great Leap Forward, the failed attempt to collectivize farming and exalt the peasant that led to one of the greatest man-made famines in history. Then the Cultural Revolution, the war against Chinese intellectuals and the wealthy, followed. In this scene, John Pomfret describes how, as a child, his college roommate Joe joined in a line to punish a woman who'd been deemed too rich.
Thwack, thwack. The line moved forward. Thwack, thwack. It inched forward again. Joe reached the front of the line. A middle-aged woman, blood seeping from her nose and ears, faced him on her knees. He pulled back his right hand and, as the others ahead of him had done, smacked the left side of her face. Thwack. Then slapped her again with his left hand. Thwack. The sweat from her cheeks stung his skin. One of Joe's cousins died of starvation during that time. Another newborn cousin was abandoned in swaddling clothes at the doorstep of the Communist Party Committee and never seen again. Joe and his family survived on weeds, seeds, and the runny gruel served at the communal canteen. Whenever they sat down to eat, Joe recalled later, he would cry at the sight of the paltry meal before him. The bodies of the malnourished swelled with fluids. People told stories of cannibalism. Nationwide, more than 30 million people died of starvation.
Reporter John Pomfret. We spoke with John earlier this year. Here again is our conversation about the China few Westerners ever saw. In telling the stories of your fellow students, you say that they were both victims and perpetrators during the Cultural Revolution. We hear the story of Joe, who was just a child when he was one of the perpetrators, but also a victim. And he told you later that, you know, he was 11 years old. It was powerful. He liked it.
Well, he was allowed to play with the big boys, and he was also serving Chairman Mao. And this is what they'd been taught to since they were in swaddling clothes. So for him, this was a realization of a dream. Only later did he begin to realize that he'd been sucked into madness.
And tell us some of the other ways you discovered, sometimes later, that your fellow students had been victims of the Cultural Revolution.
One of my classmates' parents were murdered by a band of Red Guards.
They were forced to wear yokes around
their neck. They were forced to wear
neck.
Yokes around their neck, sort of like the stockades of old colonial times, but then yanked by those yokes until their necks were broken. Other classmates basically were not allowed to go to grade school. Other classmates' parents were thrown into the gulag. And then on the opposite side, some of my classmates, like Joe, were involved in beating people and then struggling even their parents. Joe himself interrogated his mother. Basically, Mao wanted to destroy the fundamental unit of Chinese civilization, which was the family, and not just bonds between parents and children, but also bonds between people and their ancestors. In order to try to break that bond between this world and the netherworld, in order to make everyone loyal to the chairman himself.
So who were these young people when you met them in college? Describe that situation. 1980, was it?
Yeah.
What did you find when you got there?
Well, the college, I mean, the age range of my fellow students was really vast. We had a kid who was 17 years old, and we had people who were 35. The fellow who was up above me was 35 years old.
Is this the fellow who was there sort of to spy on you?
Old Chu, yes.
He was, what was his title?
Well, he was the party secretary of the students majoring in history at Nanjing University, class of 1982. And his job, obviously, was to bring other people into the party, but his job was also to sleep on top of the foreigner to make sure the foreigner didn't do anything wayward, and I was the foreigner.
Right. And why were you there, John Pomfret? You say, you write that you felt like a zoo animal. It's hard for people now to know how astonishing it was that foreigners were going to China, a country that had been closed for four decades. You say you felt like a zoo animal, people staring at you.
A lot of the time it was, I mean, people would surround me and gape at me wordlessly until I would speak. And then they would say, not you can speak Chinese, but basically, you can speak. That's the expression they would use in Chinese. I wanted to go there. I mean, we normalized relations with China in 1979. I'd begun studying Chinese history, had the opportunity to go. And for me, it was a way to, you know, get out of America, sort of leave my family, sort of discover myself, and literally go to a place that was as far away from any experience I'd had in America as could possibly be imagined.
And you also felt this was going to be the big story, the reemergence of China.
Yeah, it was an enormous personal and also a cultural adventure for me.
But what was it like as an educational adventure? Because part of what Mao's campaign was turning people on what were perceived as the elite, and that included teachers, professors, educators. Books had been burned and buried. So what, suddenly we're back to education in China. What was it like?
Well, by the time I went to China, which was in 1980, and then obviously studied until 82, the country was just beginning to reawaken from this very, very difficult period where books were burned and educators were thrown into pigsties. And they were coming back, and new books were being published. Old books were being published again. Among my classmates, the most popular book was Gone with the Wind, which is known in Chinese as Piao. It was extremely popular, and so popular it was also actually quite valuable. And classmates would do a 24-hour shift with the book.
To read it.
And some kids got the shift from 3 a.m. to 5 a.m. and were often late to class because of that, but they couldn't tear themselves away because Gone with the Wind, sort of, it's romantic Southern nostalgia appeal to them about a society that is changing irrevocably and a society that has been lost. And they love that nostalgia and that romanticism. And it was a very, very popular. But that, of course, during the Cultural Revolution was considered propaganda. It was considered pornography.
It's just one of the many whiplashes that you describe living through while living in China. But the college that you describe was sort of, as you write, it's like grapes of wrath gone Asia.
That was our dorm room. I lived in a 10 by 15 foot room with seven other guys. We had no heat. Nanjing is pretty chilly in the winter, and a lot of scabrous underwear hanging on wires across the room.
Right. I'm going to move us ahead through time because you tell such incredible stories of different turns in time. You leave school, you become a journalist, a war correspondent, you travel the world, you go back, you cover Tiananmen Square and the uprising there. You find your fellow students to find out what had happened to them when suddenly, further whiplash, the country that now under Mao thought that money was dirty now has a new proclamation, which is to get rich is glorious.
Exactly. Well, I mean, the social changes, the changes in basic values were so mind-boggling to me as an observer, but to them who'd lived through this thing, it was even more incredible. And one of the great things I was curious about was how did they cope with this? And I found actually that they coped with it extraordinarily well in a way. In one way, they didn't really deal with it because they felt, in many cases, spiritually empty. But another way, they really had embraced the culture of the big screen TV and the plushy leather couch.
Oh, it's in just several years.
Yeah, literally. I mean, they have compressed history in China. They've taken 200 years of our development, squeezed it down to about 25 years.
Journalist John Pomfret, author of Chinese Lessons, Five Classmates, and the Story of the New China. When we come back, we'll have more on the transformation of the children of the Cultural Revolution. Coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with more of our conversation with journalist John Pomfret. We spoke with him earlier this year about his experiences both as a student and a reporter in China, as told in his book, Chinese Lessons, Five Classmates, and the Story of the New China. In the book, John talks about his Nanjing University classmate, Joe, and how Joe made a lot of money after college collecting urine, which was refined to make a life-saving drug. Well, I asked John if this is how he got to understand the new economy of China through his former classmates.
Yeah, in a way, that whole urine economy is a window. I mean, in America, we talk about the China price, which is the Chinese factories producing more at cheaper. And he himself was confronting that as well. I mean, the cutthroat competition among his competitors, the fact that he would have to buy off government officials in order to get access for these urine supplies, the fact that his men were often beaten up by other teams of competitors. I mean, this type of cutthroat, what the Chinese call man-eat-man, not dog-eat-dog, but man-eat-man capitalism, something he confronted and I learned about just by listening to his stories.
Well, in reading that, I wondered if it just was as simple as the template that had been laid down during the Cultural Revolution of people snitching on each other, people being profoundly jealous of each other. You call it the red eye disease, yes, they do in China. Yes. That template now being laid over entrepreneurship and the economy.
Yeah, there's a real sense in China that their capitalist system, because you can't call it a communist system, it's a capitalist system, does not have any of the mitigating factors that we have in the States, which is somewhat of a Judeo-Christian ethic. We have labor unions, we have religious organizations, we have charities, we have NGOs. They can all mitigate the influences of hard-nosed capitalism.
Or try.
But in China, you have none of that. You just have really social Darwinistic survival of the fittest type of a society, which is very exhilarating if you're on the top. But it's really difficult if you're making $2 a day.
Tell us some of the other things you came to see being the effect of China having this huge engine of economy. How is it impacting, for instance, kids?
Well, the interesting thing with kids is that the competition to get into university right now is so intense. I mean, when my classmates were studying for school, I mean, a lot of these guys didn't go to high school or even grade school.
Because of the Cultural Revolution.
Because the Cultural Revolution shuttered all the schools, and so they were basically sent down to the countryside, and they had to dig ditches for 10 years. But then they got the opportunity to study, they crammed, they tested in. But now their kids, the competition is so intense, their kids are staying up to 1 a.m., 2 a.m. every night to study to get into that university exam. And these kids are 15, 16-year-old. They don't do any phys ed, and their social skills are also somewhat, you could say, backward or not really well developed, because basically they spend all the time memorizing. And they look at their classmates not so much as potential friends but as potential competitors, which is a completely different view that we have in the States.
Right. You say that while there may be this new fierce economic engine, these new economic freedoms haven't replaced old fears. There's just sort of a restless unease. That the Chinese have a word for it?
Yeah, the Chinese word is fuzao. It's this restless energy. I mean, you could say that the template for China 40 years ago, 30 years ago was fear. I don't think that fear is there anymore. People aren't afraid of the government. People have a lot more personal freedom than they used to. But instead of sort of a satisfaction with what they have, there is always this concern with keeping up with the Joneses. Will my kid be able to get ahead? And it's very, very anxious. And also, will something really change? Because the interesting thing in China is you have this liberalizing economic system, but then you have a political system which hasn't changed significantly in the last 25 years. And so that tension is felt by every person. And often the simplest disagreements can result in massive protests. Not massive, but we're talking, a couple thousand people, just by something that, in other countries could be solved with, for example, a court case or whatever. Yeah. But Chinese don't have that ability to deal with their issues like that. And so most recently in Northwest China, there was a big protest, a very violent protest over hot water in a school district, which you wouldn't really see in America.
Yeah. John Pomfret's book is called Chinese Lessons, Five Classmates and the Story of the New China, tracing classmates from Nanjing University in the class of 1982, which he attended, to today. Quick last question. I think it exemplifies, in a nutshell, the story that you tell. It's the incredible range of the life of your own wife. Hmm. You met her on a trek with friends in China. She's Harvard-educated. She'd returned to China to run this trekking company. And as you write, the Communist Revolution drenched her family in blood. Her great-grandfathers and uncles were executed because they owned land. Her father witnessed a family eating its own child during the Great Famine. Her mother became so depressed she drank insecticide and committed suicide right in front of her. You're wincing. I mean, it's a terrible story. So poor they only owned a flashlight, I think it was. This girl went to Harvard? I mean, what a whiplash.
Yeah, I mean, she's amazing. So, but I'm not objective. But but she's not, I mean, she's very rare, but also there's lots of other people like her. And my classmates are like her. They've dealt with this difficulty by kind of picking themselves up and moving on. And it's remarkable the spirit of the people. And so in a way, you know, my book is a testimony to the spirit of these people, that despite all the curveballs that life has thrown them, they still sort of get up and swing again and, you know, and continue going on. And so, I mean, that's the one thing that has amazed me about this country, is that it was down for so long, and then Deng Xiaoping gave them the opportunity slowly over the course of the last 20 years for people to become the agents of their own fate. And they never had that chance before. And arguably not even before 1949 did they have that chance before. And now they've become agents of their own fate. And you see people finally actualizing themselves in the most amazing of ways. So from my personal experience, my wife is totally extraordinary. But looking at it more broadly, there's many people like her. Many people like her who've had these difficulties and just said, forget it, I keep on going.
John Pomfret, again, the extraordinary book, Chinese Lessons, Five Classmates in the Story of the New China. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, a quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, as the next Congress gets ready to deal with the thorny issue of immigration, we'll hear why thousands of children come to America illegally each year. They're looking for their moms. Also, the year in sports and the world's best whistler. That's all tomorrow. Stay ahead, much more ahead, including the legacy of Gerald Ford, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush remembered the country's 38th president today as a gentleman who reflected the best in America's character.
He assumed power in a period of great division and turmoil. For a nation that needed healing, and for an office that needed a calm and steady hand, Gerald Ford came along when we needed him most.
President Bush speaking today of Gerald Ford, who died yesterday at 93. A Republican congressman from Michigan, Ford was never elected president or vice president. He took over as VP when Spiro Agnew resigned, then became president when Richard Nixon left office in disgrace after Watergate. Ford served a little over 2 years in office before he was defeated by Democrat Jimmy Carter, who today called Ford one of the most admirable public servants and human beings I've ever known. Well, joining us on the line from Washington is American political historian Dr. Alan Lichtman, who teaches at American University. Welcome.
My pleasure.
And we are hearing a lot today about how Gerald Ford was the right man at the right time. But he also, as everyone knows, pardoned Richard Nixon just a month after he, Ford, became president, either robbing or, some say, sparing the country a trial. Which do you think? Where do you fall on that?
I originally, of course, was completely outraged that we didn't have our chance to really comb through all the nasty details of Watergate, but those have pretty much come out. I think it was probably a reasonable decision in the end, and I don't think, by the way, that the conventional wisdom is at all correct on this. I do not believe it was the cause of Gerald Ford's defeat when he sought re-election on his own terms in 1976. It would have been far worse for Gerald Ford to have been seeking election in the midst of a divisive, rancorous trial of Richard Nixon. I think Jimmy Carter would have blown him away under those circumstances. As it was, he came within a couple of points of beating Jimmy Carter despite being president during the fall of Vietnam, the terrible images of those helicopters taking out the last Americans, a bad economy, and a real inability to get much done in the face of a Democratic Congress.
So Dr. Lichtman feels that maybe in retrospect it was the right thing to do to pardon Richard Nixon, but today's Los Angeles Times editorializes that the pardon was a mistake. Our system of government would have been better served by letting the legal process take its course, no matter how uncertain, and that President Ford may have been too nice a guy.
Well, I don't think he was a nice guy pardoning Richard Nixon. I don't think that was what was behind it. I think he really believed that for him to function as president and for him to heal the country, as he put it, he really had to get the long national nightmare of Watergate behind him, and this was the only way to do it. I think he was surprised a bit by the fact that it pleased nobody.
Before we move on to other aspects of Gerald Ford's presidency, just how do you weigh in on what we're reading about today, that some feel that this might have been a psychological move on his part because he had an abusive father who was divorced by his mother, and he, the son, didn't have a chance to forgive him for that, and that it might have been, you know, him replaying some aspect of his own life and making that pardon, the pardon he could never make of his own father?
Yeah, I think that's a bit speculative and far-fetched. I think there are harder, more immediate political and more immediate psychological reasons.
How would you say he was as a president?
Well, he certainly was not a great president. He was certainly not a near great president. But he did have an important role in history. And I would compare that to a president who was a great president, George Washington.
Really?
Yes. And here's how it goes. Mm-hmm. George Washington was great, not so much because of what he did. Can you tell me the big legislation of the Washington era? Nobody can.
No.
But George Washington was great because of who he was. The essential person to hold the fledgling republic together at its most critical period. Gerald Ford was important because of who he was, not because of what he did. He was a down-to-earth, decent guy. I'll never forget the George Will column which said, you know, he's the only recent president we could imagine buttering his own toast in the morning.
Sure. The day after he assumed the presidency, he made his own breakfast and went to the front door in his PJs to get the newspaper.
Exactly. That's who he was. And that's probably, in a sense, what the country needed. In a sense, he was the right man in the right place at the right time. After the twisted brilliance of Richard Nixon, the imperial presidency that he had foisted on the country, and of course the many nefarious crimes of Watergate that went far beyond just the break-in, that really subverted our democracy and our agencies of government.
Dr. Alan Lichtman, a couple of other images that come up when we hear the name Gerald Ford. Of course, we've talked about Richard Nixon, but down on the list, Squeaky Fromm, the would-be assassin, Chevy Chase, who caricatured Ford on Saturday Night Live because he stumbled a couple of times.
Yeah.
All those teenagers in the White House, and of course his wife, Betty Ford, whose legacy, I don't know, may ultimately be what? Bigger in her contribution to the treatment of alcoholism.
She is extremely important as a figure in her own right, talking openly about having a mastectomy, about issues of substance abuse, and of course, opening up the Betty Ford Clinic, as well as speaking out on behalf of the Equal Rights Amendment and opportunity for women. She was really, you know, since Eleanor Roosevelt, the first lady who spoke most deeply, most eloquently, and most movingly about creating opportunities for women in American life.
I just can still remember some hazy image of the Ford family. And, you know, we're talking about a president and the children talking about having an intervention with her. I mean, it was just quite a role modeling for other families struggling with that.
Yes, I mean, you know, here, as we said, was a down-to-earth family trying to cope with so many of the same problems that so many ordinary families have. And people could identify with Betty Ford and identify with Gerald Ford, which is why I believe he came as close as he did. He should have been blown away in that election, but he wasn't, I think, because people understood his fundamental decency. Mm-hmm. It was absolutely remarkable.
Well, Dr. Lichtman, it's been noted that the current Vice President, Dick Cheney, was Gerry Ford's chief of staff. Donald Rumsfeld was his defense secretary. Compare and contrast, you know, the current presidency with Gerald Ford's. I mean, what do you think those ties mean?
I think those ties are very important in that Ford really promoted and brought these figures into greater prominence than they had before and laid the basis for their subsequent career, particularly in the case of Vice President Dick Cheney. However, I think Gerald Ford would find himself very much out of step with today's politics and very much out of step with the Bush administration. Gerald Ford was famous for saying, "We can disagree without being disagreeable." I think he would be dismayed by the extent to which politics has become rancorous and polarized in the Capitol today.
Dr. Alan Lichtman, professor of history at American University in Washington, D.C., on the late Gerald Ford. Well, still to come today, creative cuisine and classic vinyl, music and food to ring in the new year. That's coming up. You're listening to Here and Now. Sales of new homes rose, and the number of unsold older homes fell in November, according to today's report from the Commerce Department. The numbers give some hope that the housing slump could be ending, and they coincide with the thinking of a new report from Business Week magazine. Editors at the magazine recently asked 58 experts to look ahead at the coming year and weigh in on some key economic questions, like, is the Fed going to raise or lower the cost of borrowing money? Will the profit boom turn to bust? And what impact will falling home prices have? Joining us on the line from New York is James Mehring. He's economics writer for Business Week magazine. And James, right now the economy isn't growing as fast as expected. Yes, homes may be selling more, but the prices are lower than many sellers like. So first of all, do you think, as others do, that this is going to send the economy into a tailspin?
We don't seem to think so, and most economists don't seem to think that that will actually sink the economy. It will have some impact. Indeed, as house prices fall, that leads consumers to perceive their wealth as being a little bit less than it had been. But builders seem to be adjusting quite rapidly.
Well, let's ask you, first of all, about some of the side effects of the housing slowdown. You know, when builders aren't buying lumber and homeowners who can't sell or are selling low don't have cash to spend, or when homeowners aren't taking loans on their homes because they don't think that their home is worth that much anymore, doesn't that have a ripple effect on the economy?
It can, and very much indeed it can. And we seem to think that consumer spending will slow down a bit, but it won't stop because mortgage rates, as the Fed holds the rates where they are at a fairly reasonable level, mortgage rates have actually stabilized. And in recent weeks, they came down, which helped prompt consumers to refinance.
And by the way, when do your experts see this housing situation turning around? When are builders going to start breaking ground again?
It seems to be in the second half of the year. Right now, builders have really clamped down on new activity, but they still have to get through all the homes that they were building. And that's still putting quite a few houses onto the market right now.
Okay, to your second question, and you touched on this already, will the Federal Reserve cut or raise the interest rates, the cost of borrowing money? What do the experts say to that?
They seem to be split. There seems to be a small camp that believes the next move by the Federal Reserve will be a rate hike, but a lot of economists see the next move as being a rate cut.
Third question. You asked your experts whether the profit boom will turn into a bust. Now, first of all, we're hearing about this profit boom. The CEO of the Goldman Sachs investment firm received a historic year-end bonus of $53.4 million. We read in your report, corporate profitability was the highest in four decades. And where does that fit into what you're calling a soft economy?
Corporations have done an excellent job keeping a lid on costs, keeping a sharp eye on expenses, which helps raise the profitability of each item or service that they provide. They've done such a good job over the years that even if demand softens a little bit, as we were expecting, that the overall pot of cash that these corporations are getting is quite good. And what's more, corporations have done a good job of keeping a lid on their total amount of debt.
Do I suspect, too, that perhaps laid-off workers are saying at this moment, yeah, they did a really good job of winnowing down their workforce, too? Is that a part of it?
I think that is. It's definitely unfortunate for those who lose their jobs, and that shows up in the unemployment numbers. Companies, I guess, would argue that what we're trying to do is make our company the most profitable, so that in the long run, what we end up doing is bringing on more workers in the end because we have this ability to become more profitable. And this is a factor of competition at home and globalization, indeed.
Well, and what do you think? Do you think the profit boom will continue?
It will not be a boom. As we say, the party does calm down in the boardrooms. The profit growth will continue, but it just won't be as strong. And this is due in part to the softer growth that I keep mentioning. Profit growth of above 10% that we've seen for so many quarters is very hard to sustain, even if the economy is going well. It's just hard to keep sustaining that level of growth quarter after quarter.
James Merring, economics writer for Business Week magazine. Well, stay with us. We'll plan your New Year's party, even if you're the only one attending. We'll tell you how to have some fun. That's all coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
I want some barbecue, chicken and fried potatoes, string beans and carrots and stewed tomatoes, cornbread muffins and candy yam, buttermilk biscuits and Virginia ham. I want to rock, oh, rock it all night long, yeah.
All right, who's hungry? If you're planning a New Year's party this weekend, there are three key ingredients: good food, good music, good friends. And we have all three right now. We've got our friends, resident chef Kathy Guntz. Hi, Kathy.
Hello.
And jazz aficionado James Isaacs. Hi to you, James.
Hi, Robin.
So we've got the food picks, the jazz picks, the friends. This song that we're listening to, James, tell us who the artist is.
The artist is Slim Gaylard, full name Bewley, spelled B-U-L-E-E, Slim Gaylard, the clown prince of jazz. And in fact, Slim was born on New Year's Day back in 1916. He left this world in 1991, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he not only played piano and guitar, he played the vibes, the trumpet, various saxophones, percussion, and when he played the piano, he played it upside down. And by that I mean he played with his palms up quite often, just as something to keep from being bored, I guess.
That is so weird. Well, okay, so that's Slim Gaylard's Eatin' with Boogie from his Smorgasbord LP.
Yeah, and he also created the language of vout, V-O-U-T. In this language, he would add the suffix vout to a lot of words. For example, when he's speaking to Dizzy Gillespie on a record that they made called Slim's Jam, he calls him Daz McSkiven's Valso Rooney. Now, there's no vout in there, but you get the idea. Rooney is also a big part of Slim's language. Slim loved to write about food. He loved songs about food. There are a number of food songs in his catalog, including a couple we won't hear today, like Matzo Balls and Avocado Seed Soup Symphony.
Darn!
He would often, in the studio, at one point, he says to no one in particular, bring me a big bowl of avocado seed soup so I can nail the seeds to the roof.
Okay. We are going to hear more of his music, though. Kathy Rooney?
Yes, Robin Rooney.
Robin O'Rooney.
We want to switch
here
over.
And now Rooney.
We want to switch over to the food side
Mickey
of
Rooney.
The segment. Mickey Rooney. Mickey, it would be Mickey Rooney Rooney.
Yeah.
Give us some tips for New Year's Eve from the food side.
Well, usually New Year's Eve is about simple and decadent, caviar and champagne. Thing about caviar is it's sort of the ultimate luxury food, and everybody thinks you have to be a zillionaire to take part in it. You don't, in fact. There's a terrific importer up in Portland named Brown Trading Company. They sell caviar, whitefish roe from the Great Lakes in Michigan for $18 for 4.5 ounces, so you can go for it. Or you could spend $270 for an ounce of golden Iranian Ocetra caviar. You could buy just a little bit to share with that certain someone on toast points, on very, very thin potato slices. And I would say that champagne is the drink of choice to go with that. But, you know, a beautiful stew this time of year, a coq au vin, chicken simmered in a good bottle of red wine with some mushrooms, let it cook up 2 days before, then you do nothing that night. The key to a good party is doing as little as possible
right
on the night of the party.
See, because you could just put out, watch this segue, James, some potato chips.
Potato
back to James.
Chips, how my mouth just drips.
Crunch, crunch, I don't want no lunch. All I want is potato chips. Potato chips, how my mouth just drips. Potato chips, how my mouth just drips. Crunch, crunch, I don't want no lunch. All I want is potato chips. No matter where it is.
Slim Gaylard, by the way, was quite popular from the late 1930s and into the 40s, and I should mention some of his hits because I would imagine that some folks out there have heard Cement Mixer, Putty Putty, Poppity Pop Goes the Motorcycle, Tutti Frutti, not Little Richard's Tutti Frutti.
Last party I went to, that's what they played.
There you go. And finally, the Flatfoot Fluji with the Floy Floy.
Right, that's it?
Yeah, Slim and Slam had the hit, Slam being Slam Stewart, bass player and vocalist, Slim's partner for a number of years.
Okay, but we are listening to
Potato Chips
from the CD Laughing and Rhythm, the Best of the Verve Years. It was recorded in 1952.
Also correct.
Potato Chips, we swing back to the rest of the menu. interview with Kathy Gunst, because you can put out potato chips.
Oh, sure. I love potato chips.
Tell us more.
Tell you more. Well, I know that you don't eat meat, correct?
Right.
So one of my... Okay, we got two of them here. Roasted vegetable platter. You take every gorgeous winter vegetable you can find, a winter squash, onions, garlic, beets, parsnips, carrots. You put them in a roasting pan. You drizzle them with olive oil, some fresh herbs. You pop them in the oven at 450, and you walk away. Mm. And an hour later, you put together a platter of the most spectacular winter roasted vegetables, serve them with a green sauce made with capers and parsley. That would be a beautiful celebratory dish that could go with a roast if you were a meat eater, or it would be your main course if you were not. There's so many different ways to go. Simple is the key. Yeah. No stress. Be relaxed. It's all about being with the people, hearing the music, sitting back, and letting go of the year.
Well, speaking of relaxing and romantic, I mean, some people have just an evening for two, and so we're going to switch the mood somewhat.
Yeah.
James, we understand you're bringing us a classic for that kind of mood, Ella.
Robin, I am. The tune is What Are You Doing New Year's Eve? It was written in 1947 by Frank Lesser. He's the man who gave the world Guys and Dolls and How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, so a very successful Broadway composer and lyricist. Ella's recording was made in 1960 with Frank Duvall and his orchestra, and indeed it is very romantic.
Maybe it's much too early in the game. Oh, but I thought I'd ask you just the same. What are you doing?
Suddenly, just feel so
gorgeous,
relaxed, don't you?
Yeah.
What would you, Kathy, do for this kind of a mood?
Little mini raspberry-filled chocolate cakes. They're like souffles, but none of the fuss. You mix about four ingredients, pop them in the oven 15 minutes before you're ready to relax.
And this is when one realizes that, you know, potato chips really don't make it at a time like this, because you've got some of these right here in these little ramekins. Is that the right
ramekins,
word?
Ramekins, yep. Little chocolate souffle, one for each, or share.
It's just, they're beautiful, and they're kind of, you know, harder on the top, and then look at that. Inside,
yeah, oozy, and you've got a whole layer of fresh raspberries right there in the middle.
Hey, give me a hint for this, because when you were making these today in our kitchen here, I kept saying, don't slam the doors, everybody, but that you say that wouldn't have hurt them. What's a great tip for making the best souffles?
Well, these souffles, they don't have beaten egg whites. You avoid all that fuss. It's just chocolate and butter and a little bit of sugar and a tiny bit of flour. It's almost like a flourless chocolate cake more than a souffle, but you can see they've been out of the oven for 5 minutes. They're still crowned and puffed. And, you know, if you think about it, this is your last taste of 2006. What could be better?
It's wonderful. And by the way, we'll have the recipes, the songs, a lot more for you on our website, here-now.org. In the meantime, James, as we enjoy our souffles, you've got something to underscore that. Duke?
Duke, but what I have is the traditional New Year's song, the tune that always rings out the old and rings in the new, Auld Lang Syne. And, of course, Guy Lombardo and his Royal Canadians owned this song years ago when New Year's Eve from New York was broadcast nationally on television. Mm-hmm. But Ellington recorded Auld Lang Syne kind of as a tribute to Guy Lombardo and his Royal Canadians. This is from 1962, Duke Ellington and his orchestra, Auld Lang Syne. Happy New Year.
Same to you.
Happy New Year.
Jazz, food, good friends, what more do you need? We've been talking with Here and Now's resident chef Kathy Gunst and jazz aficionado James Isaacs. All of their tips will be at our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.